Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, Andrew Wedderburn's novel, The Crash Palace, finds Audrey Cole taking a car on a midnight ride and reminiscing and so much more. We'll get talking about it. It's out by a Coach House Press, and he's part of the Thin Air Winnipeg International Writers Festival. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Now, the genesis of this book, you were in bands, you've hit the road and traveled around. Does this go back quite a ways? Was this something that was germinating, when you were touring with Hot Little Rocket or, supporting someone else? Cause there's a lot of elements that seem to be maybe strip mined from your own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I started writing the character that turned into Audrey Cole probably in about 2007. And at that time, yes, Hot Little Rocket was still actively out on the road. We'd spent probably 6 or 7 years going back and forth across Canada, largely Western Canada, the kind of Winnipeg to Victoria end of things, but we were out in Toronto. We went as far as Halifax. We went to Quebec a few times. We did the circuit, kind of the London, Ontario, Windsor, Kitchener, all those places. So yeah, I had all of those experiences of being in the van, playing in empty bars in unfamiliar places. And especially because we were back and forth to Vancouver so often, especially through, Highway 1, Highway 3, those mountain road, writing these scenes about this young woman who was really into driving.
So the character of Audrey Cole, you said, dates back to that time. So you imagined someone else hitting those roads instead of the bandmates in the van at that point? How did you kind of land on Audrey?
The original scenes that I wrote for Audrey were about her being a teenager and learning to drive and buying and selling cars. A friend of mine had told me stories about his time as a teenager as a rally driver and kind of buying and selling the cheapest cars possible. And I did what you do. You kind of absorb the details from those stories that people tell you in passing, and you put it through you try to put it on a page. So I was exploring this idea of this young woman who was doing just that, who loved being alone on the road. When I first was imagining her, she was in that landscape around Canmore, which is something I was familiar with. When I was a kid, my family lived in Canmore for a year, and we were back and forth from Okotoks, where we had lived before. So I was on that stretch of road a lot. And I started imagining someone learning to drive in that stretch, it all started coming together. And at a certain point, I wrote a scene. I think I was actually I can remember doing this. The band was up in Edmonton. We were going to play a show in Edmonton, and I had a bit of time. So I had my notebook with me. So I was sitting in a restaurant somewhere on White Avenue, and I wrote the scene about this same character, Audrey, but this time she was a little older and she was standing on the side of the highway. She'd been hitchhiking and a van stopped to pick her up. And I wondered, who's in the van? And of course, because of the situation I was in, well, who's in the van? There's a rock band in the van. What if she became their driver? And then that became the story. That became the genesis of the novel, that idea, kind of giving the character was there for me, and it was a matter of kind of placing her in the right situation where the story would start to grow from.
So that's 14 years ago, 2007. Over time, then returning to the Audrey character, did you feel she matured or changed or somehow kind of moved away from your original kind of conception of her, or how did you kind of develop a character like that over a decade?
Yeah, a couple things happened. Part of it was, yes, it took me a long time. It was kind of a long struggle to write this is my second novel. So I had a lot of second novel anxiety. I had a lot of second novel, sophomore blues that people in all kinds of other creative endeavors can probably relate to. You know, you have a bit of you publish your first novel, you're on top of the world, and you kind of crack your knuckles, or at least I did, and said, okay, well, time to write a new one. And that should take me about 6 months. And then kind of the expectations that are in your head all creep in. So part of it was, it took me a long time because I got bogged down. And so my own life kind of grew and developed, and I obviously got a lot older in that time. The other thing that happened, and this is kind of a window into the process. At the time I was working, I had this other character as well that I won't really talk about. But I basically, there was two parallel narratives, and I was working and I was working at it, and I showed it to my editor, Alana Wilcox at Coach House. And I said, I think I tell this story in the recording I did for Thin Air, but I showed the draft in probably like 2010, 2011 to Alana. And she said, Andrew, I know that you think that if you work long enough at this, that these two narrative threads are going to start having something to do with each other, but I need to tell you now that they're not. And you need to pick one and focus on it and basically take what's interesting from the other and let that character go. And obviously that's a tough thing to do. Like it means walking away from a lot of work, but it was the right thing to do. She was right. I was basically working on two things simultaneously, thinking that they were going to become the same idea, and they weren't. But so as a result, and I won't talk about that other character, but as a result of taking the interesting things from that character's story and applying it to Audrey suddenly have this life in the immediate present, and the previous the stories about her driving and with the band are in the past, and in the present Audrey is this single mother who lives downtown Calgary on 12th Avenue and has a very kind of different life. You know, she walks down 12th Avenue to take her three-year-old to daycare, and she goes to her office job downtown Calgary. And that and the story, the kind of like narrative engine of the novel becomes like what happened in between. And that became the work that I did.
Okay, so you raised a few questions here. One, working with an editor, you know, as someone who's been in a band, is it similar to like the role of a producer in terms of putting an album together, or like are those vastly different experiences? What's that working relationship like?
Yeah, it absolutely can be. And I mean, there's different kinds of editors and there's different kinds of producers. And Alana at Coach House was the editor for The Milk Chicken Bomb, which was my first novel. And I have a tremendous respect for her and a great working relationship with her, partly because like when I showed her the manuscript of The Milk Chicken Bomb, however long ago that was, in about 2005 or so, it was a long way from being done, but she immediately saw what I was trying to do. She basically said to me, it seems like you're trying to do this. And she described it succinctly. And I said, exactly. And we worked together. She basically gave me the cues and the coaching on getting it to where it needed to be. So that created this like tremendous amount of respect. And yeah, that's a lot like what you can have in a studio as a musician with a producer. There's I've been lucky enough to have that too. I've worked with a lot of different producers in my time, including, I mean, you know, Hot Little Rocket, we went to Chicago and we made a record at Electrical Audio Studios with Steve Albini, you know, like he's a whole other example, because he specifically does not describe himself as a producer, because he's not there to inform or guide the finished product. He's there to capture the sound of the band that's being created as faithfully as possible. So basically, like, for better or for worse, he's going to make you sound exactly the way you sound, Whereas I've worked with producers like Dave Alcock and Laurie Matheson here in Calgary, and Laurie and I have developed this tremendous friendship and artistic partnership over the last 10 years. Laurie wants to be involved in like what this should sound like, what this should be. And he becomes kind of that, he takes that classic producer role where he kind of becomes a creative member of the band, kind of making suggestions about, it seems like we're trying to make something that sounds like this. If we tried something like this, that might help produce that.
Yeah, Albini, I think, is described himself as a sound engineer, right? Like that's his focus. Yeah,
exactly.
And that would be, I think, maybe more like a copy editor or a proofreader, some sort of like.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great. He'd kind of be the equivalent of like the world's most thorough and exacting copy editor, proofreader. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other question that came up in terms of you talking about, you know, the band and then the gap between writing books, you know, the notion is like you have your whole life to make your first album and then you have about 2 years to make your follow-up.
Yeah.
Is there a similar pressure to writing? I mean, particularly because obviously like if you're an artist, you usually, especially in a band, you've got multiple voices, whereas as an author, it's just yours.
I think that I certainly felt like there was pressure like that after finishing the first novel and starting the second, and that became paralytic for me in a way. And that's kind of why I had that 13-year stretch. I had this tremendous pressure on myself that like, okay, now that I have become, I've written this novel. Now I have to become a writer and I have to like write a novel that will be well received and is going to make me a lot of money so that I can walk away from my day job and only write novels from here on in. And I, you know, like looking back on it, somebody that has a background in punk rock like I do, where it's about doing it because you love it and about finding the audience that works for you, and it's about, you know, your own practice, I should have known better, right? I should have known not to put that pressure on myself. But, you know, like life and psychology are funny things. And I kind of realized eventually, like, no, what matters is like writing, because I love it, and writing the best work that I can, and that will find the audience that it'll find. And when I'm done one, I'll start another. And I've kind of made... I'm doing my best not to put the expectations on the outcomes of the work, because the outcome should just be that it's the best thing that you could make. And if you did it well, it should find the audience that it can.
That notion of doing it because you love it. At one point in the book, there's a scene when, you know, at a period when Audrey's been driving the band around for weeks, they play differently one night. Right. And she describes it as like, you know, the Lieberman became the Lieberman, right? Like all caps. Yeah. And then she asked them, like, if you can play like that, why don't you? And Rist's, you know, kind of responds like, you know, you need to understand kind of like, we can't always be like this on stage.
Yeah.
Is that something that you feel in terms of like, as a creative person, like that there's only so many times you can tap into a wellspring or perform in a way that like is pure.
Yeah. And there's a lot there. And in Rist's and Rodney and the group, right. The Lievermen are this aging kind of country, instrumental surf country, rock and roll roots thing. That has kind of a limited audience, and that, yeah, on specific nights they are fantastic, but they're also kind of old and tired, and they kind of carefully measure out the effort that they give according to the situation in order to preserve themselves, which I think is a tactic, especially in performing, that you kind of learn and absorb. And they're playing in Golden I think it's in Golden, and they actually play songs. They don't play their own songs. They play songs people know. They play, you know, country hits. Dick Move sings, and they, you know, they sing Johnny Cash and Lee Hazelwood, and people love it and they dance. And they can do that because they have the capacity and the skills. But what they would rather do is just play their own songs, even if folks don't necessarily like that. And so, yeah, it's about, for them, it's kind of about this. We do this because it's what we want. And there's another dimension there. And this is a really a thing about music, but about a lot of artistic practice. The other guys in the band are kind of a bit younger than Rodney, who's the elder statesman. And Rodney, he was in a bunch of well-loved bands in the 80s. He was in kind of this invented proto-punk rock band in Edmonton that was inspirational to all these guys. So they're kind of doing it partly out of devotion to Rodney, even though Rodney isn't somebody that anybody under the age of 40 has any affinity to or interest in. So there's that dimension too, where that artistic or aesthetic experience that you have as a young person that kind of like sparks you, that will command loyalty to you in you for a long, long time, maybe your whole life. Even if it doesn't make sense, and even if it ends up means you're spending a lot of time playing to nobody in Kamloops.
Right. Now, the character of Audrey, she's restless, right? Like, I mean, you start with her getting, you know, like starting to drive around and then like trading in these cars and wanting to be a rally driver and stuff like that. But even when the circumstances happen that she's snowed in and she's at this crash palace, like she can't sit still. She starts, you know, gathering up bottles and doing work and things like that. Was there some thought to the fact that then she becomes a single mom who, I mean, is busy, but like is kind of stationary?
Yeah.
Like, because you said, you know, you didn't necessarily have that adult thing until you abandoned the other character and kind of put these stories together and started kind of filling in the gap of how she ended up a single mom. But putting her in that situation as a single mom where her life is pretty fixed, mm-hmm. pushes up against the Audrey that you introduce early on. How did you kind of develop that, or like what was the purpose of kind of making that her the bookend?
Exactly. That was the kind of narrative action of the novel is meant to be about kind of contrasting. Audrey is this restless person who wants to be kind of free to do what she like, and freedom for her is about motion, and it's solitary in a sense for her. She's happiest when she's alone, and free to just kind of experience things at her own pace. And so obviously that there's tension there when someone has a young child that's dependent on them, is kind of financially restrained in a lot of ways, and becomes stationary. So that tension between kind of like freedom and movement and stasis and uneasiness is sort of what I hope is the emotional qualities of the narrative. And then, yeah, it was about once I had the idea to make that the novel, it was about planning out a story that would take her through that and have the audience kind of experience the different poles of that and bring that to this kind of crisis point where she does these unwise, reckless things that jeopardize her own safety and jeopardize her family, but hopefully if I've done my job, hopefully the audience will understand how she got there based on that tension and experiencing her experience of that tension.
Well, and it puts her in a situation, like a physical situation, not just the emotional situation of like kind of like stasis with the child, but like an actual situation in which she can't really do anything for a while.
And yeah.
Kind of, it's in like all of her motion is internal at that point.
Yeah, exactly. For your listeners, without getting too much into it, basically Audrey gets stuck far from any place. And it's that being stuck that is kind of like the crisis of the novel. And so, yeah, that was, I wanted to kind of explore these different aspects around this concept of being stuck versus being free, being trapped versus being free.
The titular Crash Palace, is it inspired by, like, is there an actual hotel somewhere in Alberta that's in the middle of nowhere?
No, there isn't a real place like that. The Crash Palace in the novel is this kind of like abandoned sort of CP hotel style building, this big six-story red brick building that's on the side of a lake north of Nordegg. So there's nothing there for real, but it's kind of modeled, like, especially in the experience of being a musician, like, there's a lot of places out there in the world that are like the Crash Palace, in that they're kind of like these sort of semi-secret places, venues, hideaways. They're kind of operating somewhat illegally and kind of away from the public eye. And people go there to kind of like experience this kind of freedom in different ways. And so there's some of them, you know, I've been at music and art venues, and they can be really wonderful, right? Like, they can be really kind of wild, creative, experimental spaces. But they can also attract people who enjoy that kind of being out of the public eye for different reasons. And people can gravitate to it for for other purposes, right? And you can meet a lot of different characters in a place like that.
So if the Crash Palace is inspired by kind of some places or spaces you've known about, Sue Father, who, you know, is a performer within the context of the book, is that based on a performer?
Sue Father isn't a specific performer. Sue Father is kind of like, there's any given city that you go to and you get into the punk rock scene, there will be these kind of like legendary punk rock performers from the mids. Like, there will be somebody who is like the person who started the first punk rock band in whatever city it is, right? And that person often takes on this kind of mythic quality, and their performances will be these kind of, they become these really tall tales about how wild and out of control their performances were. So that Sue Father was the leader of the group that Rodney was in Edmonton in the 70s, Sue Father and the Fathers. And then she comes back in the narrative at the end, not as a musician, but actually as a stage magician. And she performs magic for a crowd in another kind of like strange hidden space. And I wanted to explore the similar, like, the magical qualities of a lot of these artistic experiences that have such a profound impact on our lives.
Those spaces, I mean, you know, this is set in Calgary. A lot of people's outside conception of Calgary doesn't include kind of like the dingy, weird punk rock type things. Is this an attempt to kind of like show, like, every city like that has stuff like this below the surface?
There's There, yeah, yes, there's, I feel like, and I've seen a lot of places like that in different cities. You know, I've seen them in Edmonton, and I've seen them in Winnipeg, and I've seen them in kind of across the country. And then Calgary, like I've kind of lived my whole life in or around Calgary. And I came up as a musician in the Calgary scene, and I love it dearly. And Calgary had, yes, Calgary did have a lot of kind of like strange, odd places, some of which are gone. Some of which have become somewhat legendary, some of which have evolved into other things. You know, like One Yellow Rabbit Performance Theater, which isn't referenced in the novel, but is an example of something that kind of grew out of kind of like a more underground scene in Calgary. One of the things about Calgary, especially in the 80s, which is before my time, like I got into the scene in kind of the early 90s, but I knew people who were there in the 80s. Calgary was not on the circuit, right? Like touring bands didn't come through, touring artists didn't come through. So if there was some kind of artistic thing, if there was a style of music, if there was a style of theater that you were into, you basically had to go and make it yourself. And people did. And so Calgary had this like really vibrant scenes around all kinds of underground music, all kinds of underground performance, all kinds of underground theater, because people had to make it out of necessity.
So the pressures you felt with book two, are you working on a third one, and has the dynamic shifted? Has your psychology changed around kind of work on writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm about 20,000 words into the next novel. It's going pretty well, I think. I basically, my job is to write the best fiction that I can, in the hours that I have available. Right now, the hours that I have available are kind of like at night after I get the kids into bed. You know, my kids are 3 and 5 now. If I can have them both asleep by like 8:30, 9 o'clock, that's a triumph. And then I can uncap the pen and open the notebook and just do some work. And I think I have a fairly healthy relationship with that now. You know, I don't have to sit down and like write the novel and solve the problem all at once. I just have to sit down and fill a few pages with the understanding with myself that like half of what I write on the notebook will be good enough to type into the computer. And then when I sit down and work at the computer, everything is subject to change. And, you know, there's good ideas in there, but it's bad ideas. And there's no problem with having spent time on bad ideas. So, you know, you just have to kind of like have a practice and work at it.
Well, The Crash Palace, I look forward to whatever comes next from you, Andrew. It's available through Couch House Press. Andrew Wedderburn, thanks very much for taking some time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.